Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Christian Studies, a channel on the New Books Network podcast. I'm your host, Crawford Gribben. Today, my guest is Kevin Ingram, Professor of History at St. Louis University in Madrid. And we're delighted to have Kevin on the program today to talk about his new book, Converso Nonconformism in Early Modern Spain. It's just been published by Palgrave 2018. Kevin, congratulations on the book and welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Pleased to be on the show.
Well, we're delighted to have you. Before we start talking about your book, could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yes, well, I'm English. I did my PhD in the United States. It's in early, the degree was in European studies with an emphasis on Spain. And before that, I went to Sussex University in England. My degree has always been in history. My first degree was in the history of in English and American history, and at California I did my degree, as I said, in European studies.
Very good. And you've been working on Spanish history, and especially Golden Age Spanish history, for some time.
Yes, well, I originally, when I went to do the PhD program, I was interested in looking at modern history, and my interest was probably more towards the 20th century on the Franco period, the Spanish Civil War. Mm. When I left Sussex University, actually, I forgot to mention, but when I was at Sussex University, I started to write a book on a member of the International Brigade, who just happened to be Winston Churchill's nephew, a man called Esmond Romilly,
right,
who achieved fame later on. He eloped with one of the Mitford sisters.
Right.
They went off to the United States.
Another famous dynasty.
And so I was interested in that. I'd spent some time in Spain, so I spoke Spanish. I wanted to go back to, I'd spent some time outside of university. I wanted to go back, and I thought that that would be my interest. That would be the thing that most attracted me to Spanish history, was the 20th century. But while I was going through the program at San Diego, I got interested in Golden Age Spain, 16th century Spain, 16th century merchants. It really started through looking at merchant activity with the Indies, with the New World. A lot of it was obviously based through the port of Seville, which had pretty much a monopoly on this trade. And then through reading around this, I kept noticing that these conversos, this group of people known as conversos or new Christians were involved in that trade. And they seemed to be involved in general in the cultural life of that city. And as I discovered elsewhere. And so when I was, when I got to the stage where I was looking for a dissertation topic, having sort of examined a number of avenues and then really discarded them, I went back to the conversos and very glad I did.
Well, I'm sure all your readers will be glad you did. You've produced a book which is incredibly rich and incredibly atmospheric. The front cover itself gives a sense of the almost claustrophobia and danger and tension of the relationship and context that you describe. It's a big book, isn't it, Kevin? How many words is it?
Too many to start with for Palgrave, because I noticed, yeah. He said, can you cut some of this out? And, you know, and I said, sure. And I didn't ever get around to cutting out as many as I promised. But my editor, she was very nice about this. And so in the end, she said, okay, well, I won't have any problems with it. I don't know, about 140,000 words.
Yeah, it feels big. It feels big. And I mean, it's incredibly well researched. The research base is extraordinary. I think something like one third of the page count is footnotes and bibliography, isn't it? It's a powerfully impressive piece of work.
Well, I'm not really a person who's, you know, well, the reason for that was that I saw this as a narrative and I didn't really want to get sidetracked. There was a lot of information I needed to cover there. And I thought, no, I want the reader to get involved with this story and follow it through. And I don't want these asides, very important ones, it felt. But as I was writing them, I felt, I'm losing the dynamism. And so that's why there were so many footnotes here.
Well, it's packed with great stuff and well worth reading. And there's a lot of terms in the title that many historians of early modern religion might not be familiar with. And conversos is of course, the key term that you explain so well and use so frequently through the book. The conversos are new Christians, as you explained, but by the 16th century, they've been Christian for some time, haven't they?
Yes. Well, the converso, it's a phenomenon. A converso in Spanish just means convert. But at the start of the 15th century, there were attacks on Jewish neighborhoods throughout Spain. And during these attacks, sometimes it's called a pogrom, as a result of these attacks, and in a period of perhaps a decade or so after them, with a lot of pressure on the Jewish neighborhoods, that probably we think round about a third, or perhaps even more, of the Jewish community, which was a very large one anyway in Spain, that community, about a third or so, perhaps more, converted to Christianity. These converts were known as new Christians or conversos. Converso meaning convert, but it wasn't just the converts, but it was their descendants, because old Christian society wished to, I think, sort of delineate between true Christians, true Spaniards, and this lesser type of Christian, and so they were really stigmatized as people who came from families who'd converted as well. And this created problems with them, not only in the first generation, but subsequently.
So that's fascinating, Kevin. Tell us about the nature of these problems. What was the structure of Spanish society? And in what way did it marginalize the conversos?
Yeah, well, what happened to start with was that you have a converso community, most of whom have entered Christianity. They've been through force. And so there was always a suspicion on the part of the old Christian society that they weren't sincere Christians. So that the conversos stayed in their neighborhoods, the Jewish neighborhoods, or in neighborhoods close by. They maintained very often the first generation ties with the Jewish community as well. So they were suspect. So that was one reason why they sort of they weren't really able to, assimilate. But the other major problem, and perhaps even more of a problem for them, was that Jews anyway were an urban group of people. They were involved in finance. They were involved in as merchants in economic activities. They were intellectuals very often. Most Jewish men would be literate because they would have to, they needed to be literate to read the Torah, which was sort of commanded of them. Mm-hmm. And as a result of this, as far as the Jews were concerned, they didn't have opportunities to enter into society as Jews. Mm-hmm. But now the conversos, as ostensibly as Christians, they could enter into all parts of that society. And they tended to do very well in an urban environment. They did very well as merchants. They entered into local bureaucracies. They entered into the church. And they became very visible. Some of them became very wealthy indeed, married into the nobility. And they were doing something that the old Christian society never expected of them. They expected them to be more modest, I imagine. Mm-hmm. And what they found was that there was a community that was prospering, doing very well, and politically doing very well as well. And there was a certain amount of envy in this, clearly, especially among the lower orders of society that was, meeting them on a day-to-day basis. Mm. So this led to a spate of attacks on the conversos in some of the large urban areas in Spain, culminating in 1449 in Toledo with an attack on the converso community, not the Jewish community, interestingly enough, which had been attacked in the period beforehand, but on the converso community, which resulted in a statute, a pure blood statute. Mm. This was called the Sentencia Estatuto. And under the statute, no conversos were allowed into the local bureaucracy, into the church. In other words, into those areas of society that were seen as the areas that should have been occupied by the nobility, by people of some worth. They couldn't enter those because it was seen, really, I mean, although it wasn't presented in these terms, but congenitally, they came from a background that couldn't be trusted in those positions. Mm. And this was condemned by the papacy, but nevertheless, it led to other limpieza de sangre, they were called pure blood acts throughout Spain over the next 150, 200 years, marginalizing or attempting to marginalize the converso community. And that's where, really, that's where my book starts. It's as a result, what happens as a result of this attempt to marginalize this quite prosperous, quite intellectual group in society.
Huh. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Well, one of the things I learned from your book is that the converso community has had a very contingent relationship with Spanish historical scholarship as well. You mentioned Franco earlier on in our conversation. How have the conversos been understood in Spanish historiography?
Well, to start with, I think there's a certain of interest. They were sort of ignored. It was up until the 20th century, more or less. It was felt that the conversos, that at the end of the 15th century, with the expulsion of the Jews, those Jews that weren't expelled in 1492. Those that converted instead of leaving the country, that they were sort of assimilated, that they really just sort of went into sort of the cultural backwards, if you like, and they really didn't have any kind of cultural influence on Spain whatsoever. The great golden age in Spain in the 16th and 17th century, that was driven by old Christians. And I think it was seen generally that having the country having ridden itself of its alien minorities like the Jews and the Muslims at the end of the 15th century, they went on to this great golden age led by good Christians. Then in the early 20th century, Jewish scholars started to look at conversos, but as Judaizers or crypto-Jews, those who resisted the Inquisition. This was obviously Jews wanted to show that, in fact, this community was a resisting community. They were called Anusim. They were the forced ones, and they maintained their Jewish beliefs under under duress. So that a lot of the scholarship in the early 20th century was from Jewish scholars, as a scholarship on the conversos, that were looking into them as crypto-Jews and their relationship with the Inquisition. It was probably only after a Spanish historian, an émigré historian from the Franco regime, Américo Castro, he brought out a book in 1948 called España en su Historia, Spain in its history. And in that, he talked about the importance of the Jews to intellectual life in Spain in the Middle Ages, and how this role was taken on by the conversos in the 16th and 17th century. Indeed, he noted that probably the greatest scholars in Spain actually came from Jewish backgrounds. This was in the Franco period, and of course Franco saw himself as creating, the Franco regime saw themselves as creating a new 16th century Catholic society through having got rid of an alien presence, not the Jews or the Muslims this time, but the left, right, the Republic or the left. And yeah. So they were looking to they had their own concept of 16th century or the Golden Age. And so obviously Américo Castro's views didn't go down very well. But he was really the start of looking at the conversos as a major influence on Spanish society, other than just being Judaizers.
Fascinating. Well, what kinds of nonconformism or what kinds of resistance did the conversos participate in?
Well, the conversos, what happened as a result of Limpieza de Sangre was that the conversos were in a difficult position. They were Christians, but Limpieza de Sangre prohibited them very often from entering the religious orders, entering into government positions, entering the universities, becoming a noble, entering into the noble orders as well. And so they had to very often disguise their background. Very often, of course, they lied about their background to enter into society. And this is one of the reasons why that scholarship has been quite slow to see their influence, because they themselves presented themselves as old Christians very often and had elaborate genealogies proving that. And so Spanish scholars and others have gone back to hagiographies or early biographies, and they've seen that the biographer has stated that this or that great member of the, this Spanish humanist or mystic came from an old Christian background, and they've accepted that rather than digging a little bit further and finding from their contacts and their biographies and just looking into their works themselves that there's something which Castro himself was very sensitive to, that there's an antagonism there, that there's a lot going on there, in a subtextual way in their works. Oh. And so, yeah. So this is what was happening. What were they doing? Well, as I present in my book, what they were doing was trying to create a society in which they would belong. So they were trying to present a society that was based on merit rather than blood, that people could gain nobility and would have a position in society through merit. They were going back to, this is why they were interested, I think, in the humanists, mm-hmm. and in changing, especially Christian humanism and Erasmianism, mm-hmm. Going back to the early precepts of the church to make it an organization that was interested not in a lot of rituals or dogma, but looking at the basic ethics of early Christianity, in which, of course, the Jews themselves were present. In fact, they were, it was a Jewish organization to start with.
Sure.
And so these are some of the, this is what they get into. So they really look into private spirituality, which puts them at the vanguard of the mystics, the great mystics of the 16th century. They go back, they're very interested in humanism. I think the humanist movement is really represented by Converso scholars in Spain. Looking at some basic ethics, looking at presenting, especially Christian humanism, the views of Erasmus, that kind of thing. This is what their views were.
I was fascinated by the passages in your book where you describe the mysticism and millennialism and other kinds of prophetic interest of some of the conversos that you're interested in. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes. Well, the conversos were interested in mysticism. They were interested sort of, as I see it, well, it's not just me. I seem to be presenting myself as a person who's introducing a lot of these ideas. A lot of the ideas have been introduced before. They just haven't been readily accepted.
Right.
But a lot of the mystics, early mystics in the Franciscan movement in Spain, were conversos. Hmm. I mentioned several of them in the book. But there was also a kind of homegrown mystical movement called the Alumbrados, this Illuminist group as well, which seems to have been completely a converso phenomenon. And what they were interested in the Alumbrados, for instance, they were interested basically in having contact with God outside the church. This was an interesting thing for them because, you know, the church represented kind of an enemy to them. Mm-hmm. The church didn't want them. Intelligent conversos couldn't enter the higher echelons of the church anyway. And so this was a private communication with the deity based on love. You know, the love of God in man is God, they stated mm-hmm. very often. They had a term for this that they could. They didn't need any prior training to like in the Franciscans to communicate with God. It could happen any time at all. It was called dejamiento. Hmm. This practice, the Franciscan organization called it recogimiento, and that was collecting God's spirit. They called it dejamiento, which meant leaving yourself open to God's spirit. And it was much more relaxed than the Franciscan views on mysticism. And it could happen any time. And they got into a lot of trouble with this. It was outside the church. And naturally, the Inquisition, the Spanish Inquisition, didn't understand what was going on. But what they did feel that it was heretical. Yes.
One of the very interesting passages in the book is the passage in which you describe the career of Saint John of Avila and his emerging and declining connections with the new Jesuit order. Could you talk us through that and its relationship to your book's title?
Yeah, well, Juan de Avila or John of Avila is an example of what I was talking about as a man who's interested in Erasmus, in Christian humanism. He is formed at the University of Alcalá de Henares, which was a humanist university that was created at the beginning of the 16th century. He's a converso, mm-hmm. and he has a mission. He takes his views to converso communities in the south of Spain, in Andalusia. Mm-hmm. And it's clear to me, at least, that what he's doing, he's targeting converso communities, many of whom were still Judaizing. Others were lost, and he's targeting this community as kind of, my sense is, to be a vanguard of this reformed Christianity, this new Christianity that many humanists were talking about, this new society that was based on the basic precepts of Christ. And he forms an organization in the south, a number of colleges, a university, this organization, which his message is pitched primarily to conversos to start with, but obviously not just to conversos. It's a message that that Ignatius of Loyola is also projecting in the early Jesuit movement. And for this reason, the two movements coincide in many ways. And the Jesuits themselves, of course, are interested in promoting these new ideas through colleges, not through creating monasteries, but creating schools or colleges. And that's John of Avila's view on this as well.
But there are hints in your book that he takes up Protestant positions.
Well, he takes up, I would say, a Christian humanist positions, but Christian humanists perhaps weren't as brave as Luther to talk about. Many of the Christian humanists, I think probably even Erasmus, their religion, Christianity, should be based on faith, primarily on faith, and that works weren't so important. In other words, that you gained God's grace through believing in that Christ was your savior. Mm-hmm. And you didn't have to perform anything much more than that. You just had to believe in that in your heart. This was seen as Protestant, but I think that it was, you know, that we see it throughout a Christian humanist movement in Spain.
And do any of these conversos move into Lutheran or Calvinist religion?
Yes, certainly by the middle of the 16th century, there are two major cells of Protestants that are discovered in the city of Valladolid and of Seville, and they're prosecuted. Many of them are burnt at the stake. As a result of this, my views on this once again is that the movement, this is being spread from humanists who come out of Alcalá de Henares University. They travel south, they become important members and preachers in Seville, and they are themselves conversos. The movement itself, I believe, is a largely converso movement. And yes, they're conventicles, clandestine groups that read Calvinist literature that comes into the port, Calvinist and some Protestant literature. But I would say that mostly it's difficult to pin them down. They are certainly, they're Reformed Catholics. They're looking to reform their religion, and they're interested in the views that are coming in from a Calvinist Europe. Whether you could say that they're Calvinists or not, I don't think that they think enough about it to be Calvinist. In fact, some of the Calvinists some of these reformers who managed to escape before being burnt at the stake, and they find themselves in Calvinist Europe, they tend to be at odds with a lot of the Calvinist ideas. They're clearly heterodox, but whether you could call them Calvinist or not.
Fascinating, fascinating. One of the most important chapters for me was chapter 6 on the visual arts. Diego Velázquez, who of course has a painting which adorns the cover of your book, a beautiful cover. And in what ways was converso identity encoded in visual texts in this period?
Well, in visual texts, this is a very difficult one, you know, you can look at visual texts and you can read lots of things into them, so you have to be very careful. What I do with Diego Velázquez is I look at his work against the background of what was going on politically in the court of Philip IV. Velázquez himself was a young court painter, and he entered into a court where there was a tremendous tension, and the tension was between the Madrid society, the court society, and a large group of converso merchants that had been attracted from Portugal because they were financiers and they were fairly cheap. They lent money at rates that were slightly better, well, often much better rates than the Genoese or the Germans financiers. But as a result of going to court and lending money, they wanted to know that the Inquisition would not be prosecuting them, because very often the Inquisition would be prosecuting these people for the sins of their fathers.
Yeah.
They were attacked. People believed that they were crypto Jews. They believed that the Prime Minister of Spain, the First Minister, the Count Duke of Olivares, was in cahoots with them, and this created an enormous amount of tension. And this really is the topic of conversation during those first years that Velázquez was at court. What was interesting that Velázquez, I believe, was very sensitive to this, because he himself, I believe, came from a converso background. I discovered a few years ago that, in fact, he lied about his family to get into the noble order of Santiago, that they weren't landowners, that they were silk merchants in Seville, which was an activity that was generally considered as a converso monopoly. So I believe he himself was from a converso family. And we see his sensitivity and the regime's sensitivity to the problems that they're having on the conversos, and on this continuing interest in maintaining limpieza de sangre, or pure blood statutes, at the court, in society in general. And we see an attack on... So in the book, I look at several of Velázquez's early paintings and a couple of his later ones, in which this antagonism is seen, that he's really making a statement against limpieza de sangre, against this attacks on this minority and on prejudice in general in his society.
Mm. And of course, what your book does is to frame its discussion around his experience. The introduction begins with him painting a cross in his doublet, and it ends with that magnificent chapter in chapter six, that long and rich chapter that considers his background and career. You've written an enormously impressive book, Kevin. What kind of impact do you hope it will make in the field?
Well, I hope it'll be read. I imagine that it will be debated. I imagine it will have its proponents and opponents. What I'm interested in is that a debate, which I think after a generation of scholars that were sort of seen as part of the Américo Castro circle. Great scholars like Francisco Márquez de Villanueva, really excellent scholars. They've now also died, and I think with it, with this whole debate about the importance of the conversos in a Christian society in early modern Spanish culture seems to have gone into a lull. And what I would like to do, once again, I really like to reintroduce this debate. I think it's so important. In fact, I say it's central to the culture of early modern Spain. And so that's basically what I'm hoping will happen, that people will start talking about it again, and we'll get some people to respond to my work and hopefully write their own works. And there's a lot of scholarship yet to be done on this.
Well, I'm sure it's going to make an impact. It's a really formidable piece of work. Kevin, we've taken up a lot of your time today, and we really appreciate that. But before we wind up the conversation, could you tell us briefly what you're working on next?
Yes. Interestingly enough, I'm working on a biography of Velázquez, of Diego Velázquez, the painter. Mm-hmm. It's going to be, I don't know, provisional title, The Secret Art and Times of Diego Velázquez. And what I really want to do is I want to approach another Spain, one that's not readily available in the general histories, through looking at his background, and through that, looking at the society of the Counter-Reformation society in Spain, and some of the cultural undercurrents that don't always get to the surface. And I'd like to use Velázquez both during for his time in Seville to talk about the heterodox movements in Seville at court as well, and his time in Italy to talk about this kind, this Counter-Reformation society and its impact on him. That's the idea anyway.
Well, that sounds fantastic. I look forward to seeing it.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for your time, Kevin. Really appreciate you coming onto the show today to talk about your new book, Converso Nonconformism in Early Modern Spain, just published by Palgrave, 2018. Thank you for your time and take care.
Thank you.
And thanks to everyone else for listening today. I'll see you next time on New Books in Christian Studies, a channel on the New Books Network podcast. Goodbye.